Cool. Well, 12 years ago, I myself didn't know any of this. I had just graduated from law school. I was living in New York City. I was actually working as a labor organizer out on Long Island, New York. And I was, during the day, I'd be organizing custodial workers and factory workers and domestic workers. And every evening I would come back to Brooklyn or Manhattan and enjoy, you know, meals with my friends, dinners out, you know, dates. I mean, I, like most Americans, celebrated almost every special occasion in a restaurant. Birthdays, anniversaries, I was proposed to in a restaurant. I mean, I can remember so many beautiful, intimate moments in restaurants. And I have to say, even as a labor organizer, I can remember probably one or two of the people who actually touched my food during all of those years working, I mean, working as a labor organizer and eating out. And I think we as Americans, we actually celebrate our culture in restaurants almost more than any other culture in the world. We eat out, actually, statistically more than any other culture in the world. And yet, we almost purposefully, not purposefully on our end, but purposefully on the industry's end, don't see the people who are touching our food, which is a very intimate act, typically reserved for a mother or a lover. It's not something that, you know, you'd give to a stranger, and yet we do. Every time we eat out, we do, and we don't think about the people who are touching our food. So I myself was completely oblivious until 9/11 happened. And this is why this song is so meaningful to me, because on September 11th, there was a restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, Tower 1, called Windows on the World. About 73 workers died, and about 250 workers lost their jobs, and about 13,000 restaurant workers lost their jobs in the months and weeks following the tragedy. And the reason why it's so, thinking about this song brings that to mind to me, is that I was just telling Jeff earlier today, the workers in that restaurant, they were on the 107th floor, and there was actually an emergency door out of the restaurant to go up to the roof where helicopters were circling and might have been able to take some people to safety, but the door was locked, as it shouldn't have been. And the workers ended up either jumping to their deaths from 107th floor or burning to death. And what does that sound like to you?
Triangle Shirtwaist.
That's right. It sounds a lot like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. If you know the history of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire with all the girls who ended up dying that day in the factory, after that, we actually got some great labor law, right? In New York State first, we got some amazing labor law, and that led to the Fair Labor Standards Act at the federal level, which was these women who sang this song, their rallying cry that no more, never again will this happen. We will organize and we will win. We will unionize and we will change the laws in this country. And they did. They did. After 9/11, very similar situation, 73 immigrant workers died from all over the world. Immigrants, blacks, whites, everybody in this restaurant died. Many of them were kitchen workers because they were preparing the meals for that day. It was early in the morning, they were preparing the meals. And yet, you know, here we are 12 years later, and we haven't yet seen anything. I mean, my organization has come out of 9/11, and I'll tell you how, but we got the Patriot Act. That was the law that we got out of 9/11. And so wouldn't it be great if something like what happened out of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in terms of new laws that protected workers could come out of 9/11? And it can, and I'll tell you how. On 9/11, when that restaurant was still there, there was a union inside that restaurant called HERE Local 100. This is before they merged with Unite. They were a tiny union because less than 0.001% of all restaurant workers in the United States are unionized. So they didn't have the resources or capacity to actually support the workers who had lost their jobs. They were actually no longer members of the union. So they called me, and they called one of the head waiters from Windows on the World, Fekak Mamdu, and they asked us to start an organization in the aftermath of the tragedy. The idea was that it would initially be a support center, a relief center for all of the workers who had lost their jobs, and that's what we were doing. We were just helping people get back on their feet. But very soon after the tragedy, we were pretty much overwhelmed with cries for help from restaurant workers, first all over New York City and then all over the country. And in 12 years, we've grown into a national organization with now 10,000 members in 26 cities in 23 states around the country. Grew from a relief center to now being one that is fighting for the rights of restaurant workers all over the country. And over that time, we have won some things. We have fought and won 13 campaigns against large high-profile restaurant companies, winning back a total of about $7 million in stolen tips and wages, and implementing new policies, winning paid sick days for thousands of workers in these restaurants, and winning job security and grievance procedures and raises and promotions for thousands of workers in these restaurants. So we've done that. We've also actually organized and promoted the restaurant owners that are doing it right, because there are some of them out there. We've convened about 100 employers around the country. They range from small mom-and-pop restaurants all the way up to celebrity chefs like Tom Colicchio, who's the star of Top Chef and actually a really great employer. He's a partner of ours. So we've got these great employers around the country that come with us to City Hall and state legislatures and even to Congress to say, I'm an owner, but I believe in better wages and better working conditions for these restaurants. We've opened our own worker-owned restaurant. So the first trailer you saw was actually filmed in our restaurant, Colors. It's a worker-owned cooperative restaurant in New York City. We've opened a second one in Detroit. We're opening a third one in New Orleans. They house our training programs. We train about 1,000 low-wage workers of color a year to move up to livable wage job skills. So the question about, about 70% of the 6,000 workers we've surveyed said there's no mobility in this industry. And that's why we do the training programs to help people, particularly workers of color and immigrants, move to the best jobs in the industry. And then we've done a ton of research and policy work. The research is the basis for the book. It's also been the foundation for lots of wins that we've won. We raised the minimum wage in New York State for tipped workers from $3 to $5. We won a bill in Philadelphia that makes it illegal to deduct credit card processing fees from workers' tips, which unfortunately is legal everywhere else, including Baltimore. So we've won a lot of things. We still haven't changed that absurdly low tip minimum wage of $2.13. But I will say, of all the things we've won, for me, the most profound thing has been getting to know the stories, getting to know the people, the thousands of workers that I've met over the years that put food on our tables every day. And their stories are extraordinary. Their stories are what is in the book. But I didn't know any of that, and my dining experience has changed dramatically over the last 12 years, and that's why I've written the book, and that's why I'm here today. Because 12 years ago, I knew I should tip well. I knew I should probably tip around 20%. New Yorkers, you're told, tip about 20%. I had no idea that the tips that I was leaving were not just something on top of a wage, they were the wage itself. I didn't know that back in 1996, Herman Cain, do you remember Herman Cain?
Yes.
Herman Cain, when he was the head of the National Restaurant Association, which we like to call the other NRA. So Herman Cain and the other NRA struck a deal with Congress saying that we, the NRA, will not oppose the overall minimum wage continuing to rise as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stays frozen forever. And so it has for the last 22 years. It's been stuck at $2.13 an hour with the justification that customers pay these workers' tips and thus we shouldn't have to pay our own workers' wages. Right? I didn't know that. I knew something about health and safety. I come from California. I grew up in L.A. where in L.A. they actually put letter grades in restaurant windows about health and safety issues. So I knew something about health and sanitation. I didn't know that 90% of restaurant workers don't have paid sick days, which means that two-thirds cook, prepare, and serve our food with illnesses like H1N1, true story, or pink eye, or very severe flu. This is flu season. I didn't know that so many workers were so sick all the time. I knew something about celebrity chefs trying to vie to make it to the top. I had no idea that for most workers of color and for women, moving up the ladder to better jobs in the industry was so clearly a matter of their skin color and their gender. I didn't know any of these things. What I know now is that there are over 10 million restaurant workers in America. 1 in 10 Americans actually works in the restaurant industry. Jeff mentioned the whole food system. There are 20 million workers in the whole food system, farm workers, meat and poultry processing workers, food retail and distribution workers. More than half of the workers in our food system are restaurant workers, 1 in 10 Americans. It is the fastest growing sector of our economy, one of the only sectors to grow during the economic crisis of the last couple of years, we kept eating out. Americans kept eating out even when we didn't have much money in our pockets. It's just something we do. We kept eating out. And yet, this industry is also the lowest paying employer in America. So 7 of the 10 lowest paying jobs in America, and the 2 absolute lowest paying jobs in America are restaurant jobs. Lower than every other type of occupation, lower than farm workers, lower than domestic, lower than any other job you think of as a low paying job. The 2 lowest paying jobs in America are restaurant jobs. So what do you have? You have the largest and fastest growing sector of the US economy proliferating literally the lowest paying jobs in the country. You know, yesterday I was with a bunch of funders and professors, and one professor got up and made a presentation and said, right now the disparity has gotten so big, 1 in 4 jobs, 1 in 4 workers in America is a low wage job right now. 2020, it's going to be 1 in 2. 1 in 2 Americans is going to work in a low wage job. That growth is entirely restaurants and retail. Those are the low paying jobs that are proliferating and growing our economy. Right? I had no idea about these things. The fact that 90% of these workers don't have paid sick days, and the fact that wages are so low, can be traced entirely back to the National Restaurant Association, which has poured millions of dollars into Congress, into state legislatures, into city legislatures' hands to stop any paid sick days ordinances from happening and to prevent the minimum wage, particularly for tipped workers, from going up. And as a result of the tip minimum wage being $2.13 an hour, servers in our country, servers who you may think of in a city like Baltimore, maybe you think of the server as the rich steakhouse server who makes a lot of tips, right? Servers in our country actually suffer from three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce, right? And why? It's because they're earning as little as $2.13 an hour, and most of them are not making the tips to cover it. Let me tell you one of the stories in the book. One of the stories in the book, it's International Women's Day, is Claudia Munoz. She worked at a restaurant in Texas, an international pancake house, which I'm sure you've heard of. She worked at this restaurant. She earned $2.13 an hour. She was so poor, she had to wait to go eat at the restaurant, so all she ever ate was pancakes. So she would go eat at the restaurant. Sometimes she would have to flirt with the cooks to give her extra food because she was so hungry, because she couldn't afford to put food on her own table. She couldn't afford to feed herself. And by law, the restaurant, IHOP, is supposed to pay the difference between the minimum wage for tipped workers of $2.13 and the regular minimum wage of $7.25. But they didn't. They didn't. Not only did they not pay her the difference, they told her, we don't want to have to pay the difference, so we're going to report that you're making $7.25 with tips, which meant she was taxed on $7.25 even though she earned $2.13. And this is so common. I can't tell you how common it is for people who earn the tip minimum wage to get a paycheck that literally says, this is not a paycheck, because your wages go entirely to taxes. So all you're living on is your tips. And if you work at the IHOP and you're a woman and you work a graveyard shift, because they often put women on the graveyard shifts, guess what? You may not earn anything at all. Anything at all. You may walk away from a whole night's work with nothing. Even worse, one evening, Claudia worked a whole night, earned some tips, thank goodness, but then a couple walked out without paying their bill. The IHOP, again, illegally, this is not legal, but the IHOP required her to pay for the bill that the couple had walked out on. Now, the bill was actually more than the tip she had earned. And so she ended up paying $20 for the luxury of having worked 10 hours overnight. Right? She paid to work to the IHOP, which is a mega corporation, an international corporation, in fact. Imagine, you know, if that's the big national corporation, what it's like to work in any random restaurant that where there isn't the kind of HR department and corporate, you know, monitoring that might occur in an IHOP, right? We've seen these issues pretty much pervasively across the board. So it's Claudia who's actually growing our economy. You know, when we think about who's growing our economy, who are we building the economy on? Whose back are we building the economy? Who do we think of as the leaders of our economy? We may hear of Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, but it's Claudia who's building our economy. It's Victoria who's building our economy. Victoria, who worked for 22 years for $2.13. And then her daughters started working in the industry, also earning $2.13. One of her daughters started working at the Red Lobster. Well, guess what? The Red Lobster is part of a mega corporation, the largest full-service restaurant company in the world, called Darden. It's the largest company you may never have heard of. It owns the Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse, Eddie V's, Bahamas Breeze, Season 52, and about 8 other brands. Largest full-service restaurant corporation in the world, and the one that has been leading the charge to keep the minimum wage at $2.13 an hour. So here's this woman working 22 years for $2.13, can barely afford to pay the rent, couldn't have Christmas, and then her daughters end up going into the industry, working for the same company that is the reason, that is the cause, the fact that she has earned that little for so long. Right? This is a company that, unfortunately, back in the fall of 2011, they announced a partnership with Michelle Obama and her Let's Move campaign, saying that they were going to provide healthy food for kids at the Olive Garden. That the same time they had made that announcement, there was a server in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Olive Garden, who had to work with hepatitis A because he didn't have paid sick days. 3,000 people got sick and had to get tested. I filed a consumer class action against the restaurant and won. And that same year, there were two other norovirus outbreaks in Illinois at Olive Gardens. Do you guys know what norovirus is? Hopefully you've all eaten dinner. Norovirus is the winter vomiting bug. It's really awful. And 50 to 90% of norovirus outbreaks in the United States can be traced back to sick restaurant workers. And in Illinois, there were two instances of norovirus outbreaks, both from the Olive Garden, both from sick workers at the Olive Garden, right? This is the company that's saying they're providing healthy food for kids, right? It also is the company that's not just following industry standards by not providing paid sick days. They're setting industry standards by making the law, by paying Congress to keep the laws the way they are. And I'm no joke, every year we infiltrate the NRA's lobbying days. We go in, we pretend like we're a restaurant owner, we sit on them. Last year we actually did a flash mob as Speaker Boehner was addressing them. It was great. But every year they're there, they descend upon Capitol Hill, literally hundreds of them, from McDonald's and Taco Bell and Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and they visit every single congressperson, every single one. And how do I know they're handing money over? Sure, there's the lobbying dollars, which you can get from public sources. We know they're paying millions of dollars, right, in contributions to these folks. But we also actually have restaurant worker members who work at the Capitol Grill right across the street from Capitol Hill, where the workers are considered invisible, so they see these deals happening right in front of them with Congress members and pharmaceutical companies and the restaurant industry, right? And don't care or know that these workers are watching them and paying attention, right? So what I'm trying to say is that this is not something organic or natural. It's not because the industry has low profit margins. In fact, this industry has higher profit margins than most. 4 to 5% profit margins across the board compared to a giant like Walmart, also a horrible employer, which has 1% profit margins. This industry's doing okay for itself. But it just refuses to pay its own workers' wages and asks us, every person who eats out, to pay its workers' wages for them. So I ask you, in any other context, an employer asking somebody to work without paying them, what is that called? That's called slavery, when somebody's asking you to work for nothing, which happens again and again and again in this industry. Literally, you work for nothing, or in Claudia's case, sometimes she actually paid for the luxury to work. So you've got an industry that is very, very, very disparate, right? Incredible inequalities. In the case of Darden, 532 times ratio between the CEO, who makes $8.5 million a year, and the workers in this industry. Thankfully, there's something we all can do about it, and thankfully, we have never seen such an incredible moment of change as we are now in this moment, and I'll tell you why. So we knew that we could have local victories after local victories, and we were, but we knew that nothing would change, nothing would be more important for us than changing that abysmally low tip minimum wage of $2.13 an hour, because it was the greatest evidence of the power of the National Restaurant Association. So we've been fighting that for the last several years. First thing that we did is we approached your very own Donna Edwards from Maryland, who introduced the first bill in U.S. history to address restaurant workers' issues, called the Wages Act. Working with us, she introduced the Wages Act that would increase the tip minimum wage from $2.13 to 70% of the regular. Or if it went up to $10, $7. So more than a tripling of wages for these workers. It was a big deal for us, but we needed leadership in Congress to take that on, right? We needed leadership in Congress to listen to Donna Edwards and support Donna Edwards and make something happen. And finally, last June, it happened. Congressman Miller in the House and Senator Harkin in the Senate introduced a comprehensive minimum wage bill and wholly accepted Donna Edwards' proposal to raise the tip minimum wage to 70% of the regular. It was a huge victory for restaurant workers, the first time in two decades that the tip minimum wage was being proposed by House and Senate leadership to be raised to 70% of the regular. The first time there was a proposal to overcome the legacy of Herman Cain. But still, it was just the introduction of a bill. So we kept fighting, and then we had a big lift, right? President Obama mentioned it in the State of the Union, and in fact, in his White House policy brief that evening, he mentioned that the tip minimum wage has to go up as well. Not just the regular minimum wage, but the tip minimum wage has to. It was a big moment for us, and yet, still, even the congressional leadership that introduced the bill said to us, to overcome the power of the National Restaurant Association, we are going to need to see a groundswell in America. So I've been going around the country talking about, let's build a groundswell, and then I go home sometimes at night and I think, this is ridiculous. The fact that this issue polls 70% favorably with Republicans and Democrats, and yet we still have to build a groundswell to tell our congresspeople to raise the minimum wage? Why is that? Who are they really listening to? We know, right? But we need to build that groundswell, right? And so how are we going to build it? Well, we stepped back when George Miller said to us, we need a groundswell. We stepped back and said, okay, how are we going to build this groundswell? And we saw something, that in the last 12 years of organizing the restaurant industry, something happened in the middle of those 12 years. About 5 or 6 years ago, a book came out called Fast Food Nation by a man named Eric Schlosser. Another book came out called Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. A movie came out called Food Inc. And we saw dramatic change in our industry. Restaurants around the country were, saying, we provide locally sourced produce, we provide organic free-range chicken. Whether or not they actually did was another matter. But everybody was jumping on the bandwagon saying, organic, local, right? And that was because consumers were asking every time they ate out, is this locally sourced chicken? Is this locally sourced produce? Asking every time they ate out. So we thought, wow, this is an explosive food movement, food moment. Is there a way that we could partner with this movement and actually replicate its success? So we created something called the Food Chain Workers Alliance, an alliance of worker organizations throughout the food system, farm workers, meat and poultry processing workers, food retail and distribution workers, workers throughout the food chain. And together, we said to the food movement, sustainable food has to include sustainable working conditions. We put out a report that was called The Hands That Feed Us, and Mark Bittman, a really famous writer for the New York Times, writes about food a lot, picked it up, wrote about our book, and 60,000 people visited our website on that day to download something called the ROC National Diner's Guide. So we created this guide to help consumers that showed how the minimum wage, paid sick days, and promotions practices of the 150 most popular restaurants in America, and also gave awards to 70 of our responsible restaurant partners. Gold and silver awards to employers that were doing it right. We also created a smartphone app. So for those of you that have smartphones, you can download it for free. It's called the Rock National Diner's Guide, and it tells you how the restaurants right around you are faring on these issues. So that was great. Everybody wanted the app. About 160,000 people ended up downloading the guide and the app, but we felt like we still hadn't reached our Michael Pollan moment, that moment where it became common parlance in America, organic, locally sourced, which wasn't common parlance, by the way, 10 or 15 years ago. So we needed our Michael Pollan moment, which is why we wrote the book. We wrote the book to have our Michael Pollan moment, to build our groundswell. And if we can raise this book up to a national bestseller, as was done with Fast Food Nation and Omnivore's Dilemma, we can build a real national groundswell and let Congress know enough is enough. So we have three asks for everybody who eats out to help us build this groundswell. The first is to buy the book and to let everybody you know buy the book. Why? Because we need it to get on the New York Times bestseller list. So we already made it to the top of, if, you know, those of us that use independent local bookstores, which are the best to support. We made it to the top of Powell's, which is one of the largest independent bookstores in the country, the top of the bestseller list. That was actually thanks to Unitarians who bought it on Powell's online from around the country. We also made it to the top of several of the categories of that evil online place that I won't talk about, the main place that everybody uses but shouldn't. We made it actually in that evil online website, we made it to the top of the hospitality category, beating out all the chef books. So we are now what's called a national bestseller because we made it to the top of these lists, but we are not yet a New York Times bestseller. And actually buying from your local independent bookstore reports to the New York Times, and that is the way that we can make it to the top of that list. And we need to, because once it gets there, we can have our Michael Pollan moment or our Eric. And we're getting a lot of attention. I've made the rounds. I was on CNN with Soledad O'Brien and Bill Moyers and up with Chris Hayes. I'm going to be on Real Time with Bill Maher on HBO on April 12th. So we're getting a lot of attention, and yet we still need, it's still not there. And so we need to sell another maybe 1,000 books to get there. So that's number one. Help us build a buzz around this book. Number two, we actually thought about it. We thought, okay, we're building this groundswell, but how can we go back to George Miller and prove that we've built it? What is the vehicle or the evidence that we've actually built a groundswell? So we created a new consumer organization called The Welcome Table, and we're asking everybody to go. I'll pass around a sheet afterwards, but to go to The Welcome Table, thewelcometable.net, and actually just hit join. You won't get too many emails, maybe once a month, but it'll allow you to sign a petition to now say, raise the darn minimum wage for tipped workers at the federal level. Maybe later the Welcome Table can say, let's sign a petition against Monsanto. Maybe later there can be a petition about GMO labeling. Who knows? It's about gathering for a responsible food system, because until now the food movement has been explosive and great, but guess what? It hasn't had any political power. And so we need our voices to be heard on the Hill, which is the purpose of the Welcome Table. The third thing that we ask of everybody who eats out, please do not leave this room thinking that the best you can do is tip better. Yes, I'm sure you can tip better. I'm sure all of us can tip better, but tipping better is actually not going to help, because it's going to allow this industry to continue to get away with what it does all the time, which is expect us to pay its workers wages for it. What we need to do is let our voices be heard the way we let our voices be heard around local and organic. So what we're asking you to do at the end of every meal is to actually go up to management and say, love the meal, love the service, I want to keep coming here, I'm a loyal customer, I would love to see you provide paid sick days to your workers. Or, I love the meal, I love the service. As a customer, your company paying as little as $3.63, which is the tip minimum wage in Maryland, doesn't sit right with me. I'd love to see you pay your tipped workers more. Or, I love the meal and I love the service, but I see that all your waiters are white and all your bussers and runners are Latino or Black or Asian. Couldn't you promote one of those? Couldn't you provide training opportunities? I'd like to see that. I'll give you a story of how I've done it myself. I tell the story in the book. When my first daughter was born, my husband and my daughter and I, we went to a restaurant to eat out in Santa Cruz, California. We were having a great time. My husband took my daughter. They went out at the end of the meal. I went up to the management and I said, I love the meal. I love the service, but I happen to notice that all your servers are white and all your bussers are Latina. What kinds of training and promotion opportunities have you offered these women? They seem to work really hard, and they could be great servers. And he said to me, well, I've never really thought about it. I don't think they want to be servers. They've never asked me for a promotion. And we hear that very regularly, right? All the time. And so I said, well, I just want to say, you know, as a customer, I really enjoyed my meal, but it's important to me that there be equal opportunity of advancement in the restaurant. I want my daughter, as she grows up, to see that anybody has the chance to be in any position, manager, owner, server, bartender. I want her to see that everybody has that chance and so that she can too. So it's important to me that you promote from within. And he said, well, thank you very much. You know, what is he going to say? He said, thank you very much. I never thought about that before. I don't imagine that one incident made him change all his policies in his restaurant. But I do think that if 10 or 15 people in that week or the next week said something about it, he would think about it and maybe do something about it, right? So these are the three things we need your help with. We need you to help us build a buzz around the book. We need you to join the welcome table. And we need you to say something every time you eat out. Because you know what? This industry is only going to change if we all work together. Workers, employers, and consumers to really transform an industry that impacts the health of every single one of us. Every time we eat out, and actually all the times that we don't. Because this is the largest and fastest growing sector of our economy. So we have to change it for the better of all of us. So thank you so much. I want to open it up to questions.
We're going to go to questions in just a second, but first, we're going to give you an opportunity to be generous as a people. Jim is going to play a wonderful piece for us, an offertory selection by Florence Price. And you may know that Florence Price was a composer, organist, and pianist, and was one of the first African-American women to gain prominence as a mainstream composer and performer. She was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was a pupil of Chadwick and Converse at the New England Conservatory. She taught at Clark University, and she played her own piano concertos with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And so as you enjoy this music, there will be ushers going among
them. And for her, they can, you know, got the upset in the gender bias within the industry, which is to say that all right now you say that the worker ought to be able to make a living wage out of their